Newsmakers is brought to you by the generosity of listeners like you, including Pam Adams and the Illiopian Oracles. I'm Gary Moore. On today's program,
it's just hard to even watch, to be quite honest, the kids and the families, and now the food bank. What, I mean, it's just terrible. So I think that, do I think it will matter in this election? Yes, I really do.
At a retirement party at Jimmy's Bar on Farmington Road, I caught up with Billy Halstead, the longtime head of the Democratic Party in Central Illinois. He reflects on his public service and, of course, talks politics. Also,
they won against Napoleon. that's phenomenal.
It is.
And, you know, they won, but the French just couldn't get over their defeat.
Humanitarian Tanya Snead puts the crisis in Haiti in historical perspective. But first, we take you to Jimmy's Bar on Farmington Road, where Billy Halstead reflects on a life of public service and talks Democratic politics. All right, talking to Billy Halstead, and this is what, a retirement party, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that's what they call it, I guess. You know, it's it was really humbling to see all the people here. It really was.
How many years have you been at it in terms of the Democratic Party locally?
Well, I was the chair for 23 years, and, you know, before that, I was a precinct committee person probably for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years before that, so.
It's been a while. Politics has changed. You know, a lot of people concerned about the election coming up with the former president, with this climate of hate, with there's not a bipartisan relationship in the houses of Congress. What are your thoughts when you look at elections now versus when you first got into politics?
Well, to be quite honest, Gary, it's ugly. I guess is a polite word to say, because it's just so nasty out there anymore that, you know, it's not about what you're going to do for the people. It's about what the other person's done, what bad things the other person's done. It's, you know, I want to get back to, what are you going to do for us? What are you going to do for, you know, for the people of the country, people of the county, the city, the state? And granted, you know, I think the former president has put a lot of hatred into our country, a lot of hatred. And it's just very unfortunate, you know, and I think that we've done a very good job in Illinois electing elected officials that's changed the election laws to help people get out and vote. You know, it's your right to vote. You know, and I get this state, I had this statement over the years so many times, well, I'm not going to vote. My vote doesn't count. And I told him, your vote does count, and it should count to you. You should look in that mirror every morning you brush your teeth and think, that's my right. A lot of people shed blood for the right to vote. You know, the blacks, the minorities, the women, you know, and for you to say it's not, it doesn't matter, it does matter. That's your right. And I gave an example of one time where I was in Boston at the convention in 2004, and there was a Speaker Madigan or somebody had a party, and we went to it, you know, which is common out there. And there was a couple guys working the buffet line, a young black man and a middle-aged white guy. And I asked him, you know, you guys vote? The middle-aged white guy said, well, I'm registered, but I don't vote. It doesn't matter. Gave me my spiel. The young black man said, I'd say probably early 20s. He said, man, I've never registered to vote. It don't matter. What, you know, they're all crooked. I said, now, hold on a second. Let me ask you a question. Tomorrow morning, if you opened up the newspaper or you read the news on the TV in the morning or whatever, and it said black males under the age of 25 can't vote, would you be mad? And he said, you're damn right I'd be mad. They can't do that. I said, but what do you care? You don't vote. Get out there and vote. Exercise your right to vote. Doesn't matter what it's for. Go vote every single election. And I said, once you get used to it, it's just going to be a thing for you.
Right. Now, you're a Democrat, longtime Democrat, strong advocate for the Democratic Party. This country has been really, you know, in the last 100 years or so, been founded on these two major parties, the Republican and the Democratic Party. Some people are concerned that the Republican Party, even though you may disagree with its policies or whatever, has lost its way. And there are even some Democrats saying they wish the Republican Party would get back to being a party of rationality. We disagree with them in terms of a conservative agenda, this, that, and the other, but they've gone so far right that it's wrong. What are your thoughts?
I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah, they, you know, it's there's no middle of the road anymore. There's nowhere you can just go out and work with each other to try to get things done, because they are just a flat no. It ain't happening, you know, and that's wrong. That's wrong, because there's got to be the reason that a lot of them are doing it is to get reelected. You know, it's not about what they believe, and it's not about what their constituents in their districts want or believe in. It's about getting reelected and raising money. That's what I mean. We've gone the wrong direction. We went the wrong direction on this. You know, it should get back to the people. Get back to, you know, if, hey, you know, I don't know, maybe campaign spending, you know, put a limit on it. You know, everybody gets the same amount.
Are you concerned about this election 2024?
I am. I'm very concerned. I'm very concerned, because we got to get out and vote.
Do you think Trump may be reelected?
Well, Gary, in when he got elected the first time, I tell people, I would have bet my house. And I'd have borrowed all the money I could at the bank to bet that Donald Trump would never be our president, because I didn't think people would put up with that kind of, yeah. And, you know, a guy that makes fun of disabled people, the women, things he's done and said. And I said, I'd have lost. I'd have been homeless. I said, because, you know, I never would have thought in a million years that that would have happened. And it did. So do I think it could happen again? Yes, it can. Yes, they can. And everybody better realize that, because if they don't get out to vote and get every single person they know out to vote, it's not just about you either. Get your family, get your friends, get them out there and get them registered.
Well, I'll get your opinion on three issues and I'll let you go. One has to do with Israel and the situation in Gaza. You know, President Biden came out and said Israel needs an immediate ceasefire, needs to do a better job of protecting Palestinian civilians and the humanitarian workers. This bombing of those food workers was major. I think it kind of turned some people's opinions against Israel. And now people are demanding, people like Senator Bernie Sanders, that the United States should withhold funding from Israel. And there are a lot of people who are pressuring Biden. There's going to be a big city council show out of the pro-Palestinian movement here in Peoria. You think this is a big enough political issue that could tip the balance in favor of Trump, even though Trump, you know, would be just dead right with Israel?
Exactly right. Exactly right. And that's the thing, is that, you know, what's going on there is just, it's just heartening. I mean, it's just hard to even watch, to be quite honest, the kids and the families and now the food bank. What, I mean, it's just terrible. So I think that, do I think it will matter in this election? Yes, I really do. I really feel that, because I think in a lot of the major cities that, you know, in the suburbs and the different areas that have more of a diverse community than, you know, some of the rural areas and different things, I think it's going to be a big player. It definitely is.
What about Biden's age?
You know, I've been very fortunate enough to meet the president a couple times, most recently probably last year, maybe a year and a half ago. He seemed sharp as a tack to me. He really did. And I'll give you, you know, an example. I'm on a board of America's Gold Star Families. On Memorial Day, I went out to, on Veterans Day, I went out to D.C. to a breakfast that the president had put on. And when I did, it was pretty cool. You know, everybody was walking around the different, you know, elected officials, and I'll be honest with you, I was a fish out of water. But afterwards, I went over, and the president was just out walking, mingling around, and I said, Mr. President, you know, I met you at the Spotted Cow, you know, little small talk. I said, can I get a picture with you? So I grabbed my phone, and I tried to take it. He said, here, give me that thing. And he grabbed it, he snapped a selfie when I couldn't even get it done. So honestly, I think the president's doing a fine job, and I think he'll be fine. I think he's the type of person that he knows that if he starts to struggle, he's not a company man. He's a man that's for the people. And he'll know that, hey, I can't do this. You know, he's not going to take us down. He definitely isn't going to take us down. But people have to remember, though, relate this to or use as an example, it's the Cubs against the Cardinals. You can't vote for the White Sox. You gotta pick one of them.
Right.
You gotta pick one. You gotta vote for one of them. Right. You know, you can't say, well, I don't like either one of them, because we seen what happened when that happened last time, because we had a lot of Hillary haters that, you know, came back and haunted us. So we gotta remember, you can't pick. You gotta pick one of the two who you think will be best for you.
Last thing, the economy. Even though all the economic metrics indicate the economy is doing fine, people have this perception that the economy is in the tubes, to the point where some people, I was talking to a lady who said she was talking to some black people who were saying they were going to vote for Trump because he got them a COVID check. What are your thoughts on the economy and how people should recognize that it is better under Biden?
Well, I think it's, you know, they can't be materialistic. Don't look at just material things that someone did for you, because that person is going to be there for 4 years, and what he did for you one time, he could do against you a million times over. That's going to hurt you a lot more than just that one COVID check.
So Billy Halstead retiring, when you think of the local Democratic Party, your name, your image comes up. What are your reflections? Give me two or three things that you'll miss, that you remember, that stand out, that you want to impart.
Well, you know, just all the people that I met over the years, all the good people, you know, and I was fortunate to be involved with our Chairman's Association, Illinois Chairman's Association, and got to meet a lot of good people. I'm going to miss that. I'm going to miss, you know, them conversations and strategies and different things that we did. But you know, Senator Durbin, true mentor of mine. You know, I went to him when I first even considered being chairman, because I worked on his campaign back in 95 and 96. And, you know, of course, Secretary White, you know, employment-wise, you know, he hired me and I worked for him for 23 years. Unheard of to have an elected official be your boss for 23. He was there for 24 years. That's unheard of. You just don't, you know. And then, you know, it's Jahan Gordon Booth. You know, fortunate enough to go out and recruit Jahan when we thought we was running against Aaron Schock, because I thought Jahan could beat Aaron Schock. And the way things played out, it didn't happen that way. But she still won, and look at where she's at today in leadership. And you know, that's another thing that I feel that not me, but we as a party got together and got it accomplished. So them are the type of things that I'll miss.
All right, well, we'll miss you.
All right, but thank you, Gary. You've always been a dear friend, my friend. You and Denise both, so thanks.
Thank you. On now to my conversation with Tanya Snead in our studio. And as many of our listeners know, if you turn on the news and you see what's happening in Haiti, it is a disturbing situation there. The country in turmoil, the president has resigned. What the media is calling gangs are roaming the streets, having shootouts with government forces, and the situation causes us to take a step back and look at Haiti. Tanya has been to Haiti, and she brought with her, you can't see this on radio, a book and some pictures. Hey, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
Now, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk with you and others who have been to Haiti is to share with our listeners some insight, because Haiti is one of those countries where, as I said, you look up at the television and you see, oh, wow, there's a lot of turmoil and this kind of thing. But there's a big backstory with Haiti. And I've mentioned this on our air before. Haiti, for Africans in history, is one of the few places where the Africans actually won and defeated the French, the colonial power, and declared their independence. Unfortunately for them, it was 1804, and the world was surrounded by slavery. And so some people have the opinion that Haiti lost because it won. Expound on that for me.
I think it's really interesting that, you know, when you say, like, they won against Napoleon, like, that's phenomenal.
It is.
And, you know, they won, but the French just couldn't get over their defeat. And not terribly long afterwards, I've forgotten now, maybe 20, 30 years later, the French showed up and they forced Haiti to accept this debt that ended up being something like $21 billion that Haiti had to pay back to France for its losses as a result of the revolution. And that debt that they paid for the next decade, I mean, sorry, for the next century, really kept Haiti down. And then you had in the 20th century, you had the U.S. military.
The Marines.
Right. And invading and occupying Haiti. And you have the history of the U.S. supporting dictators in Haiti.
Papa Doc, Baby Doc.
Right. Right. And so Haitians have never really, despite the fact that they won, they've never had the opportunity to really live free. And so, yeah, I think that's where you could say that even, you know, so they won, they lost.
Yeah, they lost because they won. And when we look at U.S. foreign policy, people in America are not that educated on what is being done in our name abroad. The United States foreign policy with regard to Haiti has not been good. When you look at our policy in the mid-80s, for example, with regard to the Haitian Creole pigs and rice, you were familiar with the rice situation. Educate us on that.
Yeah, it did begin in the 80s and then got solidified in the 90s that Haitians who had been self-sufficient in their rice production and selling rice to each other. You know, they had their economy in terms of rice was fine. There was, you know, there was no issues. And then the U.S. got involved and decided that Haitians weren't going to be allowed to sell their own rice. And I know that even when their president, Aristide, even when after the coup happened, one of the policies that that President Aristide had to accept in order to be reinstated as president in the early 90s was he had to accept a lowering of the taxes on U.S. rice. And whereas before, Haitians were, like I say, were self-sufficient with rice. Now they were being forced to import rice from the United States. And so when I went to Haiti in the 90s, and then I think the last time I was there was in 2009, I would look for the rice that was being sold in the marketplace. And, you know, I saw American rice brand from Arkansas, and it's ludicrous, you know, because Haitians should have been allowed to sell their own rice.
Yeah. Aristide wrote an article that I've read. It's in a book called Globalization. Haiti used to bring in about 7,000 tons of rice. Sounds like a lot, but Haitians used to produce themselves 196,000 tons of rice. So they were self-sufficient as far as rice was concerned. But yeah, in the mid-80s, the United States, the World Bank, IMF, said, hey, Haitians, you need some money, you need this loan. Okay, we'll give you this loan, but the stipulations are, is you're going to have to freeze the price on your rice, and you're going to have to allow foreign rice to come into your country. Unbeknownst to the Haitians, the foreign rice that came into the country from the United States, you say from Arkansas, at that time you had the 1985 Farm Bill, and the rice subsidy was something like 40%. What does that mean? That means that the Arkansas rice growers You know, they already got 40 cents on the dollar in terms of their rice. So when they brought their rice to Haiti, they could have it considerably cheaper than the Haitian rice. So if you and I are Haitians and we go to the market, we're looking to buy rice, then we're going to buy the cheaper rice. And I want to say in the span of only 15 or 20 years, the domestic rice growers were out of business. You said it was thousands of people.
Right. There are literally thousands of rice farmers that went out of business. And you know, and it's even doubly sad in that their rice was more nutritious than the rice they were importing from the U.S. And you know, and there was rice being brought in other ways too. When I visited in 2007, I met somebody who was working with the World Bank, and he was all proud of the fact that he was helping get donations of rice from Thailand to Haiti. And it was just astounding because they didn't need to rely on donations at all.
But was he aware?
I don't think he understood the history. And yeah, the little bit I tried to educate him didn't help. Right.
Wow. That's kind of similar, because when I came back from Haiti, I had some pictures and I was showing it to a lady, and there was a Haitian woman standing next to a big bag of rice, and on the rice it said USA, and the lady who was looking at my picture said, "Oh, wow, these people are really poor. I guess the United States donates rice to them, huh?" And I thought, "No, you don't know the half of it." And so the point that we're making, you look up at the TV and you see Haiti in turmoil. And there is this tendency to say, wow, those people just can't get themselves together. But the backstory is that there are these invisible market forces, invisible political forces, military forces, that for years have crippled Haiti. Is that fair?
Right. They've been completely exploited and brutalized by these policies, by interference, really, with foreign governments.
Yeah. Talk to me about the reforesting project that you were involved with.
Yeah. My husband and I were helping an organization for a long while. They no longer exist, but they were called Compai, and they first of all, the word Haiti, it means mountainous, and Haiti is very mountainous. And so one of the major issues in Haiti is erosion, because of the mountains, and they've also have a lot of issues with erosion because of
rain and mudslides.
Mm-hmm, and they've been so deforested. I mean, initially they were really deforested by the U.S. Marines. You know, during the occupation, the U.S. stole an awful lot of mahogany trees from Haiti.
Now, let me cut you off there, because mm-hmm. I don't want this to be lost on our listeners. When we say deforested, we're talking about a lot of trees that have been cut down.
Right. And they also have suffered as a result of, I mean, a lot of trees have also been cut down due to the fact that Haitians rely on charcoal for heating or for cooking their food. And because, you know, people are so poor, they mostly don't use gas to cook their food. And so, you know, so that the charcoal business is a major business within Haiti. And so the reforestation efforts were in part, you know, trying to combat some of this. And
planting trees?
Mm-hmm. And they really promoted fruit trees so that the farmers would feel very motivated to take good care of the trees. And so in the time that my husband and I were involved in, an actual Global Village was also quite involved in this, thousands of trees did get planted. So it was pretty exciting.
Yeah, you should feel good about that. You should feel good about that. So in the little time that we have left, I want to thank you, first of all, for sharing your story of your visit to Haiti, putting this in context, putting what we see now in its proper context. The book that you brought, Sleeping Rough in Port-au-Prince, what is that about?
So it's by an anthropologist, and he worked and lived among street children in Haiti. And I think, like, in this is perhaps my favorite book about Haiti. And
why?
I think because he gives he tells each chapter is like a story of a different child that he met, and it's kind of this feeling of he elevates their lives and brings meaning and purpose, and I don't know, there's something so beautiful about it. And
Sleeping
I think,
Rough in Port-au-Prince, Port-au-Prince being the capital.
Mm-hmm. And there are perhaps 200,000 children living on the streets of Haiti at the time that he's writing this. I don't know what the numbers would be now. It may be much worse with all that's been transpiring, you know, transpired there more recently. But I think he, in a lot of ways, he's honoring their stories and their lives. And I think this book also really helped me see that, you know, this isn't just about a country that doesn't know how to, you know, do government or all these things that people say. But instead, you know, this is even to down to these children living on the streets, this is due to policies that we were talking about of other countries. There's a quote in here I really like that I think kind of summarizes it. He's got a picture of a couple of street boys posing with their bicycle. And he says, "The lives of Haiti's poorest children are intimately linked to the lives of the poorest children elsewhere throughout the world. A global history of colonialism, small arms trafficking, structural adjustment, unilateral military interventionism, and skyrocketing debt conspires to keep the children of the poorest countries of the world in a state of utter desperation." And I guess that I think that really summarizes the book.
Yeah. And so the last most difficult question, Tanya, what can we do besides trying to stay informed? What can we do? I know there are some human rights organizations that are pushing for the Biden administration to allow Haitian immigrants into the country, because the U.S. for years has had this policy that forbade a lot of Haitians from coming into the country where other immigrants were welcome. That's one aspect of it. But what do you see us average, everyday Americans doing?
You know, I think that was like my question from the first time I went to Haiti in 1995, is what can I do? And I still don't necessarily have the best answer. You know, I think that, you know, when you're young, you might have this idea, oh, I can come and create change and I can really, you know, change the world. And you believe some of these idealistic notions, and then at the end of the day you realize how little you really can do. But so I guess what I know is what, you know, few things that like I've found that is my little part. So there's a few Haitians that I support, and I've been supporting for years, and one of them was a child that Jim and I first met through Friends of the Children of Haiti, a local organization. They had a sponsorship program, and Mora was just about 7 years old when we first started sponsoring him. And he's an adult now, and we've helped him buy tools because he learned how to do woodworking, and we, you know, still send him money regularly. And there's a woman we've sponsored for years in Port-au-Prince. And I think, you know, one thing I do is I listen to their stories, and they write me, and they'll, you know, like they're talking right now about how terrifying things are because of the violence, how people are coming into people's homes and robbing them. And then in some cases, burning their homes down. And I think that there's some meaning somehow, despite how little I can do about all of that, that I'm somebody in the United States who's listening to them and who hears them. and who's, you know, doing some small part in making their life maybe a little easier right now.
Tanya Sneed, advocate for Haiti. Hey, thanks for stopping by the studio.
Thank you.
Newsmakers is brought to you by the generosity of listeners like you. If you would like to support this or any other program on WPNV, you're encouraged to go to the MBDC website. Newsmakers on WPNV. WPNV, we're Peoria's neighborhood voice.